Nell Frizzell, and this is The Panic Years. When I was 28, everyone around me seemed to be getting married, getting promotions, buying houses, and having babies. I was single, redundant, and living with my mum. At the time, I thought it was a private crisis. Now I understand it was just my panic years, and that is what this podcast is all about. I'm in my garden. I've been a bit sheepish to admit to you all that I have a garden, because I didn't want you to think I was some kind of malevolent billionaire. But the truth is, I just don't live in London, so gardens aren't quite as hard to come by out here. In fact, we just chucked them out the back with the bins. Right now, you can probably hear a bird singing nearby, and I'm looking at a courgette seedling that's doing its best despite being fairly frequently pelted with hailstones and cat shit, and a washing line covered in tiny little knickers. And whether they are mine or my son's, I couldn't possibly say. My guest this week is the journalist, film critic and writer Casper Salmon. Casper grew up in France and was the star of a few films when he was a little boy, which partly explains why he has such a fantastic accent. I also knew that he's one of those people who struggled to find meaningful or satisfying work during his 20s and a lot of his 30s, which is something I think lots and lots of us can identify with. So, I hope you enjoy our chat. Also, please do stick around after Casper's interview, because I'll be talking to the psychologist, Dr. Sophie Maud, Dr. Soph, to find out more about what work and identity mean when it comes to our brains. How are you, and how is your body?
I'm okay. Suffering a little bit post-COVID, post-lockdown, and my body is defunct. Pretty much. Gone, daddy, gone. It's the, I pranked my ankle. I'm in my 40s and that's it. Everything is just on a downhill slope now.
Does it feel like a slow decline, or are you quite looking forward to the log flume of middle age?
Yeah, I'm actually looking forward to it. I'm hoping it comes with, you know, a loss of libido, of energy.
A bath chair.
Yeah, I'm hoping to become, to look sort of Samuel Beckett-y in my later years. I think I could work that.
Of course you could, though. You've got that very...
Wizened, yeah. Thank
wizened,
you.
Yeah. Yeah. No, well, he has that kind of, like, crinkly
yes,
face.
Exactly. Go from me to Willem Dafoe through to Beckett. That's the plan.
As a man, is growing old something that you worried about in your 20s and 30s? Or have you always had that feeling of like, bring on Beckett, I'm good to go?
I mean, I'm being really flip about it, but it terrifies the bejesus out of me, particularly because I'm a homosexual. Mm. And 40 in homosexual years is, you know, 75, 80... in straight years. So I'm already losing so much of my cachet.
I do remember a friend of mine saying, I was such a beautiful boy and I've lost my bloom.
Yeah.
And when he was in his sort of late 30s, and thinking, God. Oh yeah, being beautiful like a boy, just the pathology of boy is something that I didn't have to wrestle with particularly.
Yeah, definitely. And I've been so boyish all my life. I was incredibly boyish until really late, and when I was a young boy, in fact, I looked, you know, when I was 10 I looked 5, and when I was 15 I looked 11, and so it's really sort of stolen up on me, the fact of aging at all, and it is something that I've been wrestling with, because yeah, I've always been attached to something Peter Pan-ish, and you know, I know that I project a persona that is quite vibrant and inviting. And so I do fret a little bit about those later years when I will have lost that social aura in some way.
Oh.
Oh, well.
It is really interesting that, because I think from the outside you have, I don't think you've mellowed, but I think you've been enriched, you know, certainly by your change in work and fatherhood and all that kind of stuff. I revel in it. I revel in middle-aged Casper.
Do you?
Yeah, I love it. The reason I wanted to get you on, partly because, as you say, it's really interesting, that idea of having kind of aura and cachet as a boy. And I want to know how that then smacked into your panic years, which you very funnily said you think you were still in. When do you think your panic years started, if you can kind of identify them?
I would say about 25 onwards is when I started fretting, I guess.
And well, I was going to say, when I first met you, you were doing a job that, let's say, you weren't enormously fulfilled by. And you were very funny about Word documents and sort of the quirks of looking busy all the time in a job that didn't necessarily use up your whole mental capacity.
Yeah.
And you were single and you were living in London. And that, from an outsider or someone who was in a similar situation, is such a catalyst for panic when you're like, oh my God, what am I doing?
Yeah, that was absolutely massive for me because I've basically always sucked at every job that I had. really badly, you know, and I've been sacked from so many jobs and I have had bosses really start to hate me in ways that were obvious. And I'm not really a despicable sort of person, so that obviously testifies to the, you know, awful work that I was putting in. And so I was just going from rubbish job to unfulfilling job. And I'm not quite sure how it happened, but I had never, ever thought of myself as being able to do, you know, what I now do, which is to write and to be a film critic and, you know, come up with ideas and try and get them out there. And it just had never occurred to me because I'd never met the people who'd told me that I could. And so I was just bumbling along really very much until 2012, when I was unemployed because I'd left my job, because I considered myself to have been bullied by my boss, although it's a little bit, it's hard to work out because obviously she hated me because I was so shit at the job. and, you know, so it's hard to assess exactly what was going on there, but she was kind of horrible. Anyway, so I left, and then I had a period of not doing very much. I went and took a temp job, and in that time I thought to myself, hang on, I'm not doing anything. Why don't I just go to Cannes, the film festival? So I had the idea of going to that, and
that, like, such a good pun. Yes, I can. Like, you you got really literal.
Yeah, exactly.
What can I do? I can!
Here's the thing that I can. Anyway, and I upped and left and went to the film festival that year. And I'd already written a few things for a website beforehand, just in my spare time while I was doing these terrible jobs that I really hated and that made me so miserable. And then that was the beginning of something, because I was writing about film for them and I started blogging a bit more and I met a few people who wrote about film. And weirdly, some of them said that the stuff that I was writing was decent, and it had just never occurred to me. So that was the beginning of actually trying to make a go of something that I'd loved my whole life, which was cinema, because when I was younger, I was an actor as well. So it had been in my life for years and years.
I'm sort of interested that you said that in your sort of late 20s, it hadn't occurred to you that you could be good at anything, because you had been an actor, you know, when you were looking like a sort of, you know, you were 5 years old and looked like a newborn baby, according to your maths.
Yes.
you were good at that, surely.
Yeah, I was, but...
Then did you go too haggard? It was
exactly. they don't want Macaulay Culkin when he turns into Swamp Man. Basically, I didn't carry on with that. It was deemed frivolous a little bit and an insecure job. You know, my parents, I think quite rightly, thought that acting was not an especially safe thing to venture into, especially because, you know, I was so young. And so I did carry on with my schooling, and then I went to university, and I loved university, and, you know, I loved studying, and I actually realised I was decent at that as well. I was decent at writing. So that was a moment when I started to revel a little bit in my academic abilities as well, which were very late blooming as well, because I was such a late developer. I didn't realise I was bright until I was about 16. So university, that started to flourish a little bit. And that just led me off onto a different path because I had no ambitions at all. Mm. I hadn't ever thought about careers. And so I just took rubbish jobs forever.
I don't know. If you're someone who is bright and sociable and successful, do you think it is quite easy? Like, did you feel judged or social pressure about your crap jobs when you're doing crap jobs? Or is it of seen as... Oh, did you?
Yeah, very much so. Or not judged, but I felt pitied at times, and I felt a weight of expectation. I remember I had a conversation that I found really, really hard, but also quite invigorating with a mutual friend of ours, Laura. When we were on holiday, and I remember saying to her, "It's really tough because I know that people expect things of me," and her saying, "I know," and all of our friends think you're going to write a book, and you know, and I was temping. I think I was a receptionist at the time or something, and so nothing could have been further from what was possible. And I found that really tough because I also had ambitions for myself in the back of my mind. You know, I wanted to be doing things and I wanted to, yeah, to write and sort of to be known as well, because I'd been semi-famous when I was a kid.
Right.
That does linger in the back of your head as well, that not the word fame, but some sort of recognition does feel...
Just a little bit of renown.
I just wanted some recognition, darling.
I just want a little bit of renown. I can ask you this because I know that you are a righteous person. And as you once famously said, most of my friends could do a fairly good TED talk on intersectionality at no notice. if I said to you, like, as a white man doing a temping job, you sort of had this, people expected you to succeed. Did that also feel like a kind of, there is some privilege involved there, wasn't there? And was that uncomfortable to sort of think that, like, most people in this job aren't expected to write a book or to become famous again?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think I probably behaved horribly as well at times in those jobs. I remember one of my bosses saying, "You think you're above this." As she was firing me. She said something which, I mean, we had some really weird encounters because she said to me, "I think you think you're above this." This was doing some admin role. And I remember thinking to myself, yeah, I do think I'm above this. And I kind of am, you know, because it required absolutely no brain power. And yet, also, I was bad at the job. So there were two things that were difficult there. And obviously, it was insulting to her and to my colleagues that I couldn't put in the right amount of effort and that I wasn't giving it my all. So I do get that. And I felt that insult as I enacted it in all of those temp jobs. And every now and then, I'd be complaining about the job to people who'd been doing it for years around me. I'm sure I didn't have that perspective enough.
There is a weird assumption, though, and it obviously intersects with class and race and all sorts of other things, that people like you and me are going to be good at admin. And I am horrid at admin. I'm really bad at it. Like, I remember saying, like, at a temping agency, "You should be sending me off for labouring jobs. My dad's a labourer. I'd be a better labourer than I would be an admin assistant." But they would see, like, a woman with my voice, they'd be like, "Oh yeah, we'll send her to an office and work on reception." And I was awful at it. I cost them so much money by, like, mis-entering data and losing things and not replying to things. Yeah. And then I got a job loading lorries and I was great. I was really good at it and I liked the work and I was outside and I listened to the radio and it was much better.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah. Yeah, this sort of assumption.
David Sedaris worked as a removal man at one point, I think.
Yeah.
It's hard to imagine.
What would have been a better fit for you? I mean, writer, but apart from that, what should you have been doing, do you think?
Well, that's the thing, and I still don't know. You know, I still find it, I still find it hard to think of anything that I could do. That's why I told you I'm still slightly in my panic years, because I still don't really know what I could do apart from write. I could probably still act, but I don't want to throw myself into that.
Well, you don't want to put Willem Dafoe out of work.
Well, exactly. He's doing very nicely at last. So that would be wrong.
Are you freelance now?
Yeah, I took the leap 2 years ago, or two and a bit. Yeah, 2018. I mean, I'd been in my job at Auntie Beeb for a while, doing admin, write stuff. And I'd got worse and worse at the job as it went on. And it was so weird. I'd been doing it for about 5 years or something like that. And by the end, I could barely work out what I was doing anymore. And I'd reached the stage where I couldn't ask my bosses how to do it, because they wouldn't be able to believe that I had such a scant understanding of the role. So it was getting increasingly tricky. And I had started to write relatively regularly. Mm-hmm. And increasingly I was meeting people just out and about who assumed that I was a writer.
Right.
And that was very, very painful, because I wasn't. And I'd meet people who said, oh gosh, I love your writing, I love your work. And I kept thinking, like, you like my work in rights? You like the contract that I put through last week really badly, that I uploaded onto the Phoenix system or whatever it's called? No, you don't. You like an article that I wrote in my lunch break on a Thursday.
But Casper, you did walk around with a trilby with a little card that said press in the hat band, and you did wear a trench coat all the time, so you've got to forgive those people, because you were giving out some weird
exactly
signals.
My portable typewriter around my neck.
But that's interesting, yeah, to sort of be presenting as a writer without actually being employed as a writer full-time is a weird thing that I went through for years. Like, you know, I would put on my CV that I had been a freelance writer from the day I graduated, but I was not making my living as a writer at all.
How did you do the leap?
I got made redundant.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so it's the same as me, sort of. Redundancy led to something.
I'd sort of been building up, you know, the amount of work I was doing at my desk for other jobs was slowly eclipsing the work I was being paid for at that desk. And then the charity I worked for closed down, so we all got made redundant. It wasn't just me. And it gave me that sort of cushion that I knew I had probably a year where I was sort of subsidising what I earned with my redundancy money. And then luckily, at the end, you know, end of that period, I was managing to make a living. Are you making a living?
Oh, barely.
From writing?
No, not really.
I was going to say, what I really like on your website, in your bio, it says you write primarily about culture and queer culture, but you'll write anything, help me feed and clothe my children. I thought, yes. It's really interesting, actually, that those two things have coalesced. You went freelance and you became a dad around the same time, didn't you?
Yeah, well, those two things really are connected, because, as you know, I'm sure, when you have children, you start to ruminate on all sorts of existential dilemmas and think about your own life and mortality and who you want to be while somebody's vomiting on your shoulder. I think particularly in those moments when somebody is vomiting on your shoulder, that's when you really start to think about, you know, who you are and what it is that you want to do. And yeah, I think part of it was that I wanted to be somebody a bit more for my kids, and I felt like I had made a leap a little bit with the kids. Well, definitely a huge leap of faith. And I backed myself to make this other one. So they were really related, because I just thought, you know, what will I have been doing on this earth if I carry on with this job? So yeah, I went freelance then. Not that I've, you know, made a thundering impact since.
Oh, come on. I don't want to make you speak for all men, but I'm gonna.
And I will.
No, I'm I'm really interested in that thing about a legacy that I know for quite a lot of men, the fear that they needed to secure or make or even just start on their legacy made them want to put off having children, because they thought that children might inhibit their ability to work or succeed or achieve. Was that different for you?
Well, yeah, it was. I mean, so the kids arrived at a point where I was still bumming around, and I was in the job that I hated, that I essentially got the sack from, was I was doing that job when I started talking with my co-parents about having kids.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was in a panic then because I thought, well, is this the right time? Am I going to be able to do it? And then a friend of mine who was an early model of co-parenting to me, the writer Louisa Young, brought up her daughter, who's fantastic, with a friend of hers, essentially. I mean, they had the kid, mm-hmm. But I don't think they were ever a couple. And so she was an early model because she said to me, well, nobody's ever ready. There's never a point that you get to in your life where you think, this is it, I've got everything. Now is the good moment. Or at least I'm sure there is that point for people who are absolutely loaded and, you know, for whom everything's working. But
or psychotic.
Yeah, exactly. For people who are really deluded. But yeah, I took a lot of heart from that.
Mm.
And so that's how I went into having kids. And so, oh yeah, and so it never really crisscrossed into my ambitions because at that point I didn't have any.
How did you become a dad? Because so there are lots of people who probably are going to be like, he's gay, how's he having a baby?
Yeah, it's a great question. I had done that thing with one of my co-parents where when you're out on a drunken night with a pal, you end up on the night bus home and you say to your friend, I'll have a baby with you if you can't, you know, oh, if it gets to that point, don't worry, I'll do it. And I think I must have said it to her a couple of times, or I don't know even the circumstances, but it must have been lodged in the back of her mind.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that was just a very simple question then. And I said, yes. And then we hashed out the details of it. But really, it was that they came to me with this idea.
And did you have a parenting agreement?
Yes.
In advance?
Yeah. So yeah. We talked about it for about, I think, 2 years or so before even starting. And during that time, they got cold feet and I got cold feet. And we went back and forth on the terms of our co-parenting. When they first mentioned it to me, my assumption was that we would do half and half, and that I would have the kids half the time and they would have the kids half the time. And they basically haggled me down to less time with the kids than that. And it's actually great. So I've got I absolutely love the kids, but I've got them exactly the right amount for what I can afford to do and what I can cope with as a single man myself.
Can I ask you how much time you do spend together?
Yeah, so okay. I have the kids every third weekend and every Wednesday, and we share holidays evenly between three. So I get every third Christmas, which is really lovely. And of course they get the two others, and because each one of them wants to spend the Christmas with their family.
Yeah.
And I will get an Easter here and there, or, you know, a long weekend or whatever, if I put in for it. And it works out beautifully. It's really, really lovely.
You said then, you know, what you had capacity for as a single man. How has your life changed as a single man when you introduced children into it?
It's changed a lot of things, really. It has changed the way I date, because I think now if I'm dating seriously and looking for somebody who might be a prospective partner, if there's someone who isn't going to be good for the kids, then that's I would just, you know, cut that off immediately. And I won't even consider people who just, you know, who are into some, who would want something more casual. That is, if I'm dating, I'm actually quite happy to sleep around with with casual people. Like, sleeping around is absolutely fine, but for dating I want a certain caliber of fellow. So that has changed.
And if you bring someone home or someone comes around to you and they see toys and tinsel and kids' clothes,
yeah,
what happens then?
Yeah, that sometimes there are people who are a bit freaked out and they really can't understand. And actually, what's quite interesting is so many people go straight to the assumption that I had sexual intercourse with a woman to create the children. And some mm-hmm. guys find that not necessarily a turn on, or but something, there's something there. I think some guys think, wow, he was straight at some point, or you know, something really, really right. silly like
yeah,
that,
yeah, yeah.
and it has an impact of some sort, or it registers a kind of meaning, the fact that you might have been with a woman. And then I hasten to add that I haven't seen a vagina for years and years.
I hadn't thought about that people would assume that you had intercourse to make your babies. I feel like I'm asking something my great aunt would have asked, but here we go.
Go on.
When you knew you were gay, did you think that meant that you wouldn't be a dad?
Yeah. Even more than that, being gay had terrible associations for me because I had really internalised so much homophobia that I grew up with, you know, in the 90s, just it was all around. We really forget how homophobic a time it was. But coming out of the AIDS crisis in that decade, you know, right up to into the 2000s, depictions of gay people on television, you know, this was a bad time. And I really had a sense of myself as being a hopeless being and one without a future in some sense, partly because it was impossible to think of a model for growing old as a gay man and what kind of life I might have. And I remembered vividly gay men that I knew when I was young. Well, not that I knew even really, that, you know, that were teachers or that sort of thing. We didn't really even have that many gay men that I knew. And these people were seen to be a bit pathetic. A gay man growing old, you know, some bow-tied tragic figure, you know, singing a song at a piano, perhaps, or becoming a little bit catty in his later years. Or, you know, these were people who were seen as rather desperate because they had outgrown that boyishness that we were talking about at the beginning. And so I really didn't have a sense of a future that I could have and of what sort of life I could branch out into. And that contributed to my qualms about my career and all sorts of things. So it was a big panic.
Did you ever get that model, that sort of image, or did you just make your own? Like, can you think of an impactful figure in popular culture that changed the way you thought about being a gay man? Or did you just become a gay man?
I just became a gay man. I got better. Mm-hmm. So I managed to stop being so hateful. And I was led out of the closet, again, by a mutual friend, Laura, who really, really helped me and who was the first person who blatantly viewed me as a gay man in a way that didn't offend me and upset me.
People knew you were gay, or did you just not talk about it?
No, I just didn't really talk about it.
Holy moly, I didn't realise that.
Yeah, I didn't do anything about it for years. I was out really late, around 24, 25. And before then, I was just not doing anything. Every now and then, had a kiss. But I was not doing much.
Wow.
Because I had it twisted in my head. And so then I embarked on a whole kind of process of becoming a gay man. Now I'm a very proud and quite fiercely queer man, I hope. Mm. I really do want to be somebody who is an evolved gay person and who can demonstrate what it is to be one and how beautiful and incredible it can be to be queer. But I didn't have that in my head at all when I was younger.
Wow, I had no idea.
Yeah, and my role models were few because, I mean, it was, you know, it was people like Rufus Wainwright. And,
oh, yeah.
And, you know, and he wasn't a father. I mean, he was just a flamboyant, flaming, wonderful queer man. And when I listened to his music, I thought, my goodness, he's talking about me. Mm. So it was people like him, you know, hearing that music and feeling called to by a combination of operatic music and Cole Porter and sassy barbs, you know, at some point you can't hide that to yourself anymore.
If you started being a gay man in the world at 25 and you feel old at 40, Like, what did you do in the in-between time? Or how did you feel in the in-between time? Is this your, like, ticking clock to get it all done before you felt old?
Yeah, sort of. We're in an interesting time now because I think the internet makes us all feel older. Because it shows people apparently succeeding incredibly young, and everything has just got a lot younger. If you consider that when you and I were growing up, Nell, like, there just weren't any very young famous people. It wasn't possible, whereas now you can become famous at 13 very easily on your own. And so people, I think, have this really unrealistic idea of where you should be at a certain age, and that has shifted down by possibly 10 years, something like that. You know, when I was young, the famous people were all 30 plus, the ones who had made it, and now that's not the case at all. So I think being on the internet does tend to make you feel ancient anyway. And you know, in my own experience of appearing younger for a very, very long time, of being very boyish, also contributed. And so in that time, I did feel like I was kind of wasting away a little bit. But I never had a sense that I was at my peak or anything. And I didn't think, like, this is my time to get out there and sow my wild oats. It just didn't really occur to me. My 30s were a really good time, I think, for all sorts of reasons, where I started to realise that, like, that I was, you know, reasonably good looking and had a certain pulling power. And I started to get really into the gay scene then, and into owning that identity and loving, you know, gay camaraderie and the nightlife and the fun of it all, which had just been closed off to me until then. Yeah.
You write about film now a lot.
Yeah.
In film, have you found anything, you know, in your 30s and now into your 40s, that mm-hmm. has given you hope about the representation of queer people in popular culture?
Is it still crap? I think, yeah, it's still quite crap. I think if you consider it alongside how far we've evolved in public life on the subject of queerness and LGBTQ rights, then I do think that a lot of depictions are really, really far behind. They're the kind of Facebook to the Twitter discourse, if you will. So they're sort of catching up to what has become more complex in our understanding of queer people. And you still see, you know, rubbish like Love, Simon, for instance, a truly horrendous film. And that sort of thing is posited as an advance for queer people. And it's just depressing. It's sort of going back to the Middle Ages.
So what is it about Love, Simon? People who haven't engaged with it, what's so bad about it?
I think what it does is it puts all of the trappings of a straight rom-com onto a queer story in a way that seeks to make us acceptable to a mainstream, rather than tailoring an original story to a different experience, which is what you should do. And what you end up with is something that feels incredibly hollow and vacant and artificial and kind of hateful at times, because it implies that in order to be accepted, we must graft ourselves onto the dominant lifestyle. And it also just sucks. But, you know, when I watch that, I feel really sort of, yeah, sickened by what the mainstream sees us as. But there are some decent ones as well.
It's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, it makes me think, is, like, queer romance just innately different to straight romance? And so rather than trying to map queer romance onto a straight narrative, why don't we just make our own queer romantic film? It probably does look different.
Yeah, it does. Because we've ended up with this happily ever after for straight people. And I mean, even for straight people, if you have half a brain, you know that that happily ever after is also is a pipe dream a lot of the time, you know. But it's just about plausible to stop something at that point in time in the story and preserve it in Aspic as a happily ever after if you're using a straight model. But if you're using a queer one, then we haven't even had marriage for that long. We've had marriage for about, what, 8 years or not even 10?
Yeah.
Our sex has not been legal for that long.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're talking about stories that go way, 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 way back, centuries and centuries, it does seem absurd to me to map our kinds of stories onto a mainstream sort. And it's really depressing that we aren't trying to seek a different form for ourselves.
You've also just made me think that we have more, like, I can't think of a queer woman politician in popular culture, but we have them in real life. That shows how, like, how behind our culture is, behind our actual lived, daily life.
Yeah, you're right.
That's mad, isn't it? You wouldn't get a Ruth Davidson in a film, but we actually had her in Parliament.
Yeah, and we've got Angela Eagle. We've got a few more.
Yeah.
So it's true. You don't really get that. I just think depictions of sex are quite bad. You know, something like It's a Sin is progress in some way, but also I think it really did also make a big appeal to the mainstream, again, by kind of diluting its characters and their sex. You know, people thought that series was risque because there was a big sex montage, but it was done in a way that was comedic. It used a comedic
form. Well, it was a montage. You're right.
Yeah, it was a bumming montage, and one that seemed to say, "Isn't it all a bit of a jape?" The gay sex that they had, because it was, you know, promiscuous and a bit of a laugh, and I'm sure it was, but also, gay sex is incredibly hot. So turn me on. Let's have some erotic sex, and let's see if the mammies and pappies can deal with that at home. Because I don't think they can. What they want to see.
I think some of them will love it, and that will be very charming.
Well, that's
for
a good
them.
Point.
Hello, welcome back. Thank you so much to Caspar Salmon and his filthy mouth for talking to me about all the big stuff. I could listen to him for hours discussing sex and work and fatherhood and coming out of the closet. It really felt like an honour to talk so candidly to someone about their life like that. So many people will recognise and relate to that feeling of not knowing what you're good at and wondering what you should be doing in your life. But what's actually happening in our brains when we're struggling with work? I decided to put that question to the psychologist, Dr. Sophie Mort. I started by asking Dr. Sophie, what happens in the brain if we feel bad at our job? And how can it affect our self-esteem?
Well, so there's lots of different things that happen, but if we very quickly think about what the concept of self-identity is, I like to imagine identity as a jigsaw puzzle. And each part of the jigsaw puzzle is a different part of who you are and what you do. So, for example, woman, sister, friend, lover, cook, psychologist, terrible skateboarder. Yes. So your identity is this jigsaw puzzle. And as long as you have multiple pieces in that jigsaw puzzle, when one piece isn't quite right, i.e., for example, you break up with someone or you start doing something like skateboarding in my example, and you're very bad at it, there's kind of a challenge, a little bit of a challenge to who you are, but it's tolerable because the jigsaw is still stable. Mm. Modern day, so right now, because so many of us have been taught to believe that work and productivity is who we are, it's almost like that jigsaw puzzle has one massive piece in it. So your question about, you know, what happens if you're feeling like you're bad at your job? Imagine having a huge jigsaw puzzle with only really one big piece in it, and then you take that piece out. It totally unsettles the jigsaw. In fact, the jigsaw doesn't even look like a jigsaw anymore. In your brain, firstly, there's a challenge to the concept of even who I am. There's a sense of confusion. And our brain doesn't really know the difference between real life threat. So like there's a tiger in my room about to eat me and perceived threat. So imagine ripping out a big piece of the jigsaw puzzle or kind of challenging it. Your brain slips into threat mode, for example. You start experiencing what we call the fight or flight response. You might start feeling anxious. Your brain starts anticipating everything that can go wrong. It might start affecting your sleep. And often you meet people who start to feel a little bit like, oh, what's the point? I don't know who I am. I'm starting to feel anxious. I'm noticing I'm making more errors at work, because that's what happens when you're in kind of the threat response.
Yeah.
But another part of what happens in your brain is, and I don't know if you've noticed this, but there's a link between identity and motivation.
Mm-hmm.
So almost everything we do and choose to put our energy into is linked to an identity. So, for example, I'm having this call with you. I'm motivated to speak to you because one of my identities is being a psychologist. If I saw someone doing something that was breaking the law in the street, I wouldn't be motivated to go and say something to them because I don't have the identity of police officer. Right? So if one of your identities is challenged, that natural motivation, that energy that comes from your brain, I suppose, and into your body is decreased. So it goes, identity is challenged, motivation drops, the amount of effort you put in, which obviously drives outcome, suddenly drops too, and you start a vicious cycle. Feel bad at job, become less motivated, put in less effort, see yourself doing worse, in inverted commas, at the job. Does that make sense?
It's the most perfect encapsulation of a cycle that I think loads of us are really familiar with. That I think,
oh yeah.
I mean, you've basically described quite a lot of my 20s. Or actually, being like, anytime you start anything and you're not good at it, it's a real confrontation with your like motivation and instinct, which is to back away,
yes.
Isn't it? Like, you don't. No one likes to feel threatened in that way.
100%.
I think for a lot of us, or people in a kind of privileged position that I was in, spend our 20s trying to work out what we want to do and who we are. And I wondered if you have any advice on how we can kind of take the anxiety out of that. What is quite a necessary process, but can feel really quite sort of upsetting and triggering and uncomfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one of the first things we ask people when we meet them is, what do you do?
Yes.
Right? It's an opener to every conversation, yeah. Right? We don't say, hey, nice to meet you. What do you like? What do you love? What pleases you? What kind of upset you recently?
Yeah.
We define people and based on the answer,
what do you do?
What do you do? So totally. I think what's really interesting about that is there's a pressure to find your calling now, this kind of utopian dream where you do what you love. And I think it's making people feel incredibly anxious and actually quite depressed and hopeless for some people. I could tell you an endless list of what to do, but I think some of the basics are, recognize that most people don't actually know what to do, what they want to do. Most people feel like they're winging it every day. Just people don't talk about it. And also, every decision you make isn't final, right? So I think when people think, I need to figure out what job I need to do, they think, oh, well, I need to make the right decisions all the time.
Very good point.
I left school, did a year of a degree in art, partied so hard I ended up having panic attacks, which was obviously at the time the worst thing that ever happened to me. And then I started studying psychology because of having the panic attacks. And now I'm a psychologist. So I didn't make the wrong decision studying art. I had an opportunity to learn about something else about me from one of the worst periods of my life. And now art is my hobby, but psychology is my title.
That's such a nice way of looking at it. It's so good. And that, yeah, when you talk about calling, I mean, we're basically left with what, like nuns and paramedics. Like, who else gets that kind of calling?
Exactly. And you know, it's funny because people assume therapists, for example, they found their calling in helping people. If you think about purely my example, I came there from a very selfish perspective of trying to understand myself. So you never know when your calling, i.e. just your job that you spend time doing, will find you.
That's brilliant. Finally, sort of as a psychologist, part-time artist, extremely poor skateboarder.
Extremely poor, thank you, yes.
Why do we find change so intimidating? You know, whether that's a change in job or change in relationship, change in address, like why is it that we can lose years because we are frightened of changing the status quo? What is that?
Well, I think we need to slightly reframe the question, Because change actually can be really exciting if you know that the thing you're changing to is good for you, something you're going to thrive at, where you're going to be supported, where you can hit the ground running and it's going to go well. So I think the question is more, why do we find uncertainty intimidating?
You're absolutely right.
So, for example, you mentioned a change in job, a change in relationship, a change in address. These are things that come with so much uncertainty, right? Like, what if I go into that job and no one likes me? What if I stand up to make a speech on the first day and end up, I don't know, wetting myself in front of everyone? I know that sounds extreme, but some of us worry.
It's always wetting yourself or accidentally your trousers just falling down. I'm so scared of my bum in a new work scenario.
Exactly. Like, what if I end up by mistake exposing myself fully on day one of work? So we're intimidated by uncertainty. But the good thing about that, I think, is that once you know that that's the issue rather than change, there are things that you can do. So, for example, we know, have you heard of the anxiety equation?
No.
Okay, so you can literally imagine this like a maths equation. So anxiety equals estimation of threat or danger over, so you'd have a line underneath it, your estimation of your resources to cope.
Ah.
So most of us during times of uncertainty, firstly, overpredict threat, i.e. what really is the likelihood of walking into the office and your trousers falling down? It's pretty low. And also, what would you do to cope? Most of us go, oh my God, if that thing happened, it'd be terrible. My life is over. Rather than, no, seriously, what would I do? Okay, so I'd probably laugh and then get quite embarrassed. And then I'd grab a chair and try and cover my bits with it. And then I'd probably run out of the room and hide in the bathroom and cry and laugh. And then maybe, you know, a week later, I'd kind of probably be over it and people might like me more because they remember me as the nude girl from the first meeting. So you can actually, if you can find a way to know that you have enough resources to cope no matter how bad it gets, the uncertainty becomes more manageable. And the other thing is, and I think this is something that we really need to focus on in society, if we go back to kind of this idea of the jigsaw puzzle, what all of us need to do is focus on the areas of our identity that are not changing whilst there's, you know, so for example, say you have uncertainty in your job. Maybe you have stability in your friendships. Maybe you can lean on them as your anchor. Maybe you have stability in your hobbies. So focus on all the aspects of who you are and find an anchor, something that isn't changing while the other stuff is making you feel uncertain. And you'll honestly find it much easier.
Hello and welcome back. Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. I've just noticed that my kale plant seems to have erupted into an incredible spray of yellow flowers, and I'm not sure that's what's meant to happen with vegetables. Thank you to Casper and to Sophie for letting me pick their brains this week. And thank you to all of you who've already subscribed and listened to the podcast. Next week's guest is the journalist Rose Stokes, who'll be talking to me all about falling in love during lockdown. So please come back next Friday for that. If you've enjoyed this podcast, and actually, even if you haven't, please subscribe and leave me a glowing 5-star review so more people can find it. It makes a massive difference, feels great, and like voting, will cost you absolutely nothing.
This is a brand new audio production.